bibliographies are the basic tools of the scholar and the bookseller and the collector. You can't study an author without knowing what he wrote, and bibliographies, of course, by definition, are compilations of one kind or another of an author's production, but they exist in a very strange space intellectually, in that they're divorced from time, space, or any of the things that really happen, any of the really complex things that happen in the production of a book, and just seek to present an ideal ordering of an author's production, even though some of the greatest bibliographers, the American bibliographers, for example, Charles Evans or Jacob Blank, spent entire lifetimes chasing their material down and traveled over continents and had incredible adventures. None of this stuff comes through in the bibliographies, and perhaps that's as it should be, and yet one wonders at some point, could there be more to a bibliography? And I think Jeff Johnson, our presenter tonight, has tackled this question in a most interesting way, as you'll soon see. So without further ado, Jeff Johnson.
Thank you. On a certain day in August 1970, I turned 5 years old. And on that day, I received as my birthday present a purple two-wheeled bicycle, my first one. Now, I knew I'd be getting a bicycle, so I had two clothespins and playing cards ready for the spokes, but I'd also bought something special, which was a raccoon tail to hang off the back. So after the celebration with my family, I was taken out and given my bicycle, and I climbed on it, ready to head down our driveway, which was a hill. My father said, "Well, Jeff, are you sure that you want to do this? I haven't put the training wheels on." And I said, "No, I'll be absolutely fine." So I started down the driveway, and as soon as I started to turn, fell over just about as hard as you can fall off a bicycle. My father came running down. He picked me up. I was crying. He was attempting to console me. "We'll put the training wheels on. It'll be fine." When across the street, a car stopped. And out of the car stepped four young men. They had long hair. They had a lot of facial hair. They had tie-dyed clothes on, ripped jeans and caftans. And I had never seen the like. And I said, "Dad, who are those guys?" And he said, "Well, Jeff, don't worry about them. They're not our kind of people." And I was taken back up to the garage, and a Band-Aid was put on my knee, and that was that. But the funny thing is, on that exact day, across the Atlantic, sitting in a townhouse in Hackney, a young man with a Viva Zapata mustache and quite a bit of hair was putting the finishing touches on the poem that was to be the first poem in his first published book of poems. That man's name was Ian Sinclair. Now, that story is just to put things into perspective. Ian Sinclair has dubbed this effort My Bibliographical Odyssey, and I'd like to tell you about that effort, which is as much about the journey as it is the final deliverable. I'm often asked how I, an American, ended up getting involved in compiling the bibliography of Ian Sinclair, an author who has not really been published or promoted here in the U.S. It was sort of the culmination and combination of everything I've been interested in literature for my entire life. I have a love of British literature that goes back to my childhood. I moved on to American literature, Twain and others, when I was 10 and 11, but my allegiance shifted back when I read Great Expectations by Dickens in the seventh grade. Since then, I have devoured most of the classic British literature, you know, all the stuff that no one wants to read in school. Along the way, I've also developed a serious interest in mythology. Books have always been my passion, and I became a collector when I was 7, beginning with books I could afford for my allowance and grass-cutting money. Now, you can't be a serious collector without learning the specifics about books. And once I became an adult and started seriously collecting, I learned as much as I could. About editions, impressions, states, and issues. About bibliographic points. About how books are printed and put together. I became reliant upon bibliographies, and found that the best ones could be read almost as one would read a novel. That is to say, you could read them page by page, as well as using them just as reference tools. So what is a descriptive bibliography? Well, a descriptive bibliography attempts to show the transmission of the text as it was printed, book by book, and periodical by periodical for an author. Greg went into it a little bit in the introduction. But they're usually used by collectors and book dealers and academics, and they can be fascinating for many reasons if you're a book person. What they attempt to do is to describe as clearly as possible books as physical objects, which I think is even more important in these days when books are disappearing. As Greg said to me last summer, books are no longer transmitters of ideas. They're no longer transmitters of texts. They've now become objects of desire. Thus, in my mind, it's more important than ever to be able to distinguish the good books as you would distinguish an original painting from a copy. So, back to Sinclair. As a collector in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I started speculating in modern firsts by British authors. For this was the time of the Britlit boom. McEwan, Amos, and Barnes were the big names, with their books being bought and sold sort of as investments. I bought into this nonsense as much as anyone, and speculated on new British authors as they were published. I haunted my local Brentano's in Bridgewater, New Jersey, almost daily, virtually memorizing the stacks and keeping an eye out for any new British author who might be the next Peter Ackroyd, whose novel Hawksmore both intrigued and frustrated me. In 1993, three copies of a novel entitled Downriver by an author I had never heard of named Dean Sinclair appeared on the shelves by Brentano's. All had slightly rubbed dust jackets, due to their high gloss and the thicker-than-usual seam, where the cloth used on the spine was glued to the paper covering the boards. The dust jacket blurbs made it sound like Sinclair was akin to Ackroyd. I liked the look of it, and, hoping for a Hawksmoor-like, dark underbelly of London type of read, purchased the least rubbed copy. The following day, during lunch at work, I began reading it. I became frustrated, even angry. I remember thinking, just tell the story, get on with it. I pushed myself through it, and upon reaching the end, found that I had no idea what had just happened. See, I didn't get it. There was no story. It wasn't, in any way, Hawksmoor. But the writing stayed with me. I kept picking it up and rereading sections. It was obvious to me that Sinclair was a serious stylist, and I was able to feel a poet's sensibility in the prose, even though I wasn't a poetry guy. It kept niggling at me, so I located a trade copy of his first novel, Whitechapel Scarlet Tracings. I paid $45 for it, which, back then, was more than I liked to spend on recent modern firsts. But when it arrived, I was impressed by the craftsmanship. I was intrigued, frustrated, and challenged by both books. But it wasn't until Lights Out for the Territory a few years later that I became a Sinclair collector, springing for one of the blue, cloth-bound, gold-mark-published 1-in-26 limitations. For those of you unacquainted with Ian's work, let me tell you that it defies categorization. He began as a poet, something which I know nothing about, then moved into fiction, then into a sort of a fictional nonfiction. And these psychogeographical books are what he is known for. They, too, defy easy categorization. He walks and talks with people, then walks some more, muses, walks, makes arcane and obscure connections, walks some more and opines, mostly about London. The result is a fascinating, sometimes uneasy mix of fact and fiction. So, in 2012, I was attempting to fill gaps in my Sinclair collection. Although I had a substantial collection of his output from 1987 onwards, I hadn't purchased any of the early poetry published by Ian's Albion Village Press back in the 1970s. I contacted a book dealer selling two of Ian's early books on Amazon UK, who turned out to be a poet that I recognized from Ian's writings, who, after I recovered from my shock at who he was, sold me his inscribed copies of the Albion Village Press Lud Heat and Suicide Bridge, and who, after listening to my enthusiastic prattling on, recommended that I contact Ian directly for various reasons. This happened with several other dealers as well, because it seemed like everyone that I contacted knew Ian Sinclair, including a couple of dealers who had published some of Ian's early poetry back in the day. But I declined to contact Sinclair, not wanting to bother him. Rare, I mean scarce, Sinclair items magically started appearing. Phone calls to dealers for a single Sinclair item would turn up other, even scarcer items that I had never seen listed online. It began to feel, as Ian might say, as if energies were coalescing, and that contacting Sinclair directly might not be a bad idea. Meanwhile, I had reached the limit of my frustration with the lack of available, detailed bibliographical information on the many Sinclair limitations and ephemera. And, while referencing the excellent bibliography of Ted Hughes, I had the thought that someone should do a proper bibliography for Sinclair. My wife suggested that I should attempt it. The thought had crossed my mind, but I had flicked it away. I thought about it some more, and after mentioning the idea to publisher Mike Goldmark, who thought it was a good idea, decided to write Ian a letter, hoping that I had the right contact information, not believing that it would reach him, let alone be read. I mailed it the day after Christmas 2012, and a reply appeared in my mailbox a few weeks later. In the letter, Ian expressed interest in my proposal, as he had been thinking, only recently, how such a project might be initiated. Stunned by the coincidence, it was like something out of one of his books, we started exchanging emails as I began to research in earnest and to reacquaint myself with bibliographical procedures and guidelines. I read Bowers and Gaskell's books on bibliographical principles, revisited some favorite bibliographies, and examined as many new ones as I could lay my hands on, and tried to set some boundaries as to how much and what would be included. You see, one of the nice things about bibliography is that it allows the compiler to decide what slant he or she will take on the subject, how much to include, and what emphases will be placed, with the understanding that certain aspects and information must be present. Many modern bibliographies are written solely to assist collectors and dealers in the identification of first editions. The best ones, I think, extend beyond this. So after about a month, I decided not to set any limits, to allow anything and everything, and to allow Ian's work to set the structure and format. This decision was made for the following reasons. First of all, my annoyance at bibliographies wherein the compiler sets arbitrary constraints due to time, space, or just not wanting to be bothered with details. As I have no publishing commitment, I have no limits, and believe me, those details matter. Second, my idea that the bibliography should somehow reflect the cross-media and collaborative nature of Ian's work, as it extends to things like photographic contributions, collaborations with artists, films, installations, etc. He even provided text for a wristwatch. I developed the eccentric idea that the bibliography should reflect the eccentricity of the subject matter by being eccentric as well. So thus the definition of bibliography would need to stretch to accommodate his output. Thirdly, because everything that Ian writes is interconnected, everything should be included so as to demonstrate this interconnectivity. This includes his books interconnecting with one another and interconnecting with other books and authors. All of it is sort of woven together. Ian is more prolific than at first appears. Thus, the amount of information is huge. So I realized that I would have to control the flow of information rather than the amount. During prep work, I developed the even more eccentric idea that the bibliography should be not just reflective of Ian's work, but it should be compiled in a manner reflective of his work as well, an idea that Ian supported. Although proper bibliographies must follow certain guidelines, and traditional research would occur in libraries and online, I decided that I should meet and interview people face-to-face with whom Ian had collaborated. I would have to travel, rather than just rely on the internet and or library services. I would have to physically handle as many copies of books as possible, meet with artists and authors, filmmakers, gallery owners. I'd have to collaborate with Ian directly, take walks, make connections. Quite simply put, I'd have to work like Ian does. In his books, he often mentions the energies created by creative In his books, he often mentions the energies generated by creative efforts, and how those energies seem to feed off themselves and spawn other ancillary energies. Having never attempted anything creative, I wanted to see if this was so. It was also very important to me that this effort, if possible, reflect what I call the collaborative zeitgeist of Ian's early work during the British poetry revival, when the poets would publish one another during the mimeograph revolution. This esprit de corps was a very real, conscious attempt to support each other's work. Therefore, I would do the same, whether my contacts were artists, writers, publishers, or shopkeepers. And, on a personal level, I was to educate myself, not just in bibliographical technique and Ian's complete oeuvre, but in areas in which I lack knowledge, but Ian writes about, like poetry and art. My own artistic boundaries would be extended and expanded as I attempted to sort of rein in, encapsulate, summarize, and bind Ian's work between two covers. I would be challenged both personally and interpersonally, stepping outside my usual safe, structured routine by meeting and working with creative, artistic risk-takers. I admire artistic ability in others as I've never felt it within myself. But now I'd be taking a creative risk and hope that I'd be able to successfully navigate my way through this new territory, opening myself up to new experiences, allowing whatever was going to happen, was not something I was used to. I've called this approach, only half-jokingly, method bibliography. Like its namesake, method acting, I would try to enhance the performance, in this case the writing of the bibliography, by internalizing the subject via use of the subject's methods and approach. The end result would be a way for me to give something back to literature, which had given me so much over the years. So I planned a trip to London for the second week in February 2013. Ian Sinclair arranged to meet with me on two afternoons. The rest of the time would be spent doing research and meeting collaborators with whom Ian was currently working. I realized that I would get to fulfill a long-held dream of doing legitimate research in the British Library, and also found that the holdings at Cambridge University Library were substantial and accessible. By the time I left for the UK, I had reams of notes and items to cross-check. And so found myself in Albion Drive meeting Ian Sinclair, this guy whose strange books had fascinated me for so many years. We sat in his sitting room, chatting, finding common ground, and sussing each other out. I was incredibly excited and nervous, but he was very gracious and patient as I babbled on about my intentions and what I hoped to accomplish. After talking for quite a while, we examined some items that he had pulled from his archives, that is to say, his attic and basement. His memory was astounding. I typed and snapped photos. He talked, reminisced, and helpfully held the items as I photographed them. Next day, I spent the morning at the British Library, which was every bit the experience for which I had hoped. Then to Ian's, where he had set up in the kitchen for our work session. More photos, talk, and note-taking, with him raiding boxes, running up and down stairs, recovering memories, and me sitting, let's be honest, gawping at the treasures he had unearthed, which in some cases got him excited as well. Suicide Bridge was about to be reprinted by Skylight Press, and he had uncovered some lost Suicide Bridge material which he realized he'd like to be included in the reissue. It was a fantastic day, which I think helped solidify in both our minds that this could work. I had a wonderful time, and we finished that day with wine and curries, as his wife Anna joined us for dinner, talking families, jobs, and books. I left feeling optimistic. Although Ian had found many items of which I was ignorant, most if not all were obscurities from the little magazines of the late 60s, early 70s. The next couple days were spent in the poetry library on the south bank of the Thames. With Chris McCabe's assistance, he's the poet and head librarian, I was able to access many of the little magazines which may or may not have contained early Sinclair poetry. I soon discovered that these magazines were going to be the joy of this project. What a time it was back in the late 60s, early 70s. Poets pushing to get each other's work out there in whatever format possible. Everything from the iconic, nicely produced second Eon to mimeographed and haphazardly stapled sheets of A4 paper with hand-drawn sketches. And huge broadsheets where obscure poets rubbed shoulders with famous actors who wrote poetry. Almost every magazine had an introduction by the editors with great plans for the future of their mag, which often only lasted a single issue. Pleas for support and on the fringe poetry and art, all being freely exchanged and read in order to support the collaborative zeitgeist. It was absolute bliss to read through them, uncovering forgotten Sinclair bits and bobs. I'd like to give you an example of the energies generated by this project. Even though the poetry library was open that Sunday, I decided to take a day off from the bibliography and just walk the hell out of London. Having recently reread Downriver, I decided to head east down the Thames Path and see how far I could get, keeping in mind that my ultimate goal was the World's End pub in Tilbury, knowing that I would have to get on a train at some point, but determined to walk as far as I could. The World's End was a place I had long wanted to visit, for the Dickensian Association, Great Expectations, as well as the Sinclairian Downriver one. I had no knowledge of anything east of Bermondsey, no clue how to get to Tilbury, no idea how far it was. I left it all to chance, which, as anyone knows me will aver, I never do. I am an obsessive planner, facilitator, and logistics guy, and I was, admittedly, both nervous and excited as I set off very early, heading east on the South Bank from London Bridge. It was a stunning day, and as I walk at a furious pace, I made excellent progress. Beachcombers were out digging, and rowers were on the Thames. It was lovely. As I stopped to look back west, I saw that the top of the Shard was missing, eerily hidden in cloud and mist even though the day was clear. Rounding a corner, I almost tripped over a pair of sneakers arranged next to some torn lettuce. Why, I wondered, is there torn lettuce next to the sneakers? It was like some kind of fetish or offering. And as I turned to look back at the Shard, it appeared to be moving, as there was now a plume of mist, fog, whatever, streaming out behind it towards the south. This is where the day took on a surreal quality that remained for its entirety. I have literally never had such strange off-kilter things happen to me. Now, Ian, of course, writes of encountering bizarre things and coincidences on his walks, but that's him, as he reads the signs and looks for icons, graffiti, and things to support the theme and purpose of the walk. As I walked, things just seemed to be off. And being naturally unimaginative and empirical, I tried to account for why I felt this way. There were less people than there should have been, and long stretches of unaccountable silence, even in areas like the hotel directly across from Canary Wharf. The light was amazing. I took lots of pictures. And the Shard, when in view, had that unworldly aspect for most of the day, even as the light changed as the day warmed. I've read of people experiencing something wherein they feel like they're dreaming. I never knew what that was like until this walk. Dreamlike quality sums the day up perfectly. Little things seemed fraught with meaning, and sometimes slightly menacing. That my imagination was supplying all of this was completely new to me, but I let myself go with it, allowing myself to just experience whatever the day threw at me. I won't go into all of the details, because there's a short story in here somewhere. But I heard the same phrase repeated multiple times during the long walk, a phrase which, although commonplace, had no business being repeated within range of my hearing that many times on this particular day. I heard unaccountable footsteps several times, and there seemed to be more animals than there should have been. I was inspected by lone cats and dogs, who stopped on their way to wherever they were headed and really looked at me. I mean, stared me down. Gates that were closed when I was still a distance away were unaccountably opened by the time I reached them. Reflections and the play of light on the Thames helped to perpetuate this strange atmosphere. It's a bizarre walk that's become, I think, my favorite London walk. I tramped through expensive developments, council estates, and a city farm. I paid my respects to Christopher Marlowe in Deptford after walking through parks where, for some reason, totem poles have been installed. Through Greenwich, where I ate in a small cafe and where the crowds dispelled the strangeness. Then, back into silence, into the wastelands that are just starting to be redeveloped. To the O2, which I can never view without hearing that disdainful Sinclair guy's voice in my head raging against the pure vanity of it. Down to the Thames Barrier, then slightly inland to Woolwich, where, at the Woolwich Arsenal tube station, I found out how to reach Tilbury. I walked the tunnel back under the Thames. It was completely empty, save for me and my echoing footsteps. Then on to the Docklands Light Railway, to the station where I caught the train, then the bus, no Sunday train service, to Tilbury. The bus driver shaking his head as I alighted because, as he put it, it's called the World's End because no one ever goes there. And indeed, there was literally nobody to be seen as I made my way past the huge shipping warehouses. And it seemed only fitting that, as I passed through an empty roundabout, a fox should stop, make eye contact, then walk towards me, looking as if it were going to speak. Instead, it passed within a couple feet of me, leaving behind that distinctive odor. I continued alone, as time seemed to stretch and then disappear with the daylight. Finally, I saw it in front of me, the World's End. Before going in, I wanted to connect the end of the walk to the Thames, which was off to my right. There was a single man in oilskins tending many fishing lines set out along the stone wall, who greeted me as I approached. "What's that across the river?" I asked. "That'll be Gravesend," he replied. This Conradian Marlowe reference nicely bookended the earlier, much older, Christopher Marlowe one. I went into the pub, cold and tired, and had a reflective pint. Looking back on the day, the retrospective pleasure was enormous. So I contacted many of Ian's collaborators before I left for the UK and arranged to meet with them. Heading north, I spent the entire day in Uppingham at the Goldmark Gallery, exhaustively collating every piece of information I could get my hands on. Mike Goldmark published Ian's first novel, Whitechapel's Scarlet Tracings, as well as many of Ian's other books. His gallery is indeed the special place that Ian has described in his writings. And I visited Mike each time that I'm in the UK so that my wife and family could see for themselves what an amazing place it is. My daughter's graduation gift was purchased from Mike, and my wife fell in love with the pottery in which Mike specializes. I spent time at Cambridge University Library, where I had received permission from an eminent poet to access papers from his private archive that's held there. Amazing material. letters and bits and bobs from the 70s and 80s when the little magazines declined along with the British poetry revival, hints of lost manuscripts, abandoned projects and well-intentioned projects that somehow went awry, grudges and gossip, the ebb and flow of friendships and alliances that end in a falling out or just peter out naturally, then more little magazines and Sinclair A items. Then I headed south for the coast, where I was to meet filmmaker Andrew Cotting in his studio to discuss his collaborations with Ian. I had only recently watched Andrew and Ian's film Swan Down and was enamored of it. The two of them travel in a swan pedal boat from Hastings to Hackney, using England's inland waterways as much as possible and carrying the swan overland when necessary. Just ludicrous. During our discussion, I discovered that attempting to compile everything associated with Sinclair-Cotting collaborations was going to be difficult, as they had consciously done things in such a way that the results were meant to disappear. One prime example of this would be their purchasing from used bookshops in the Hastings area about 200 books having to do with sailing, swans, the sea, etc. They took them and they defaced them with Swan Down ink stamps and Swan Down Maxims, which are pre-printed quotations on stickers. Then they resold the books back into the Hastings book market. In other words, the books were captured, tagged, then released. This was done to disperse the energy of the project throughout the area where the trip was beginning. It was also done as a joke, with a nod to Ian's past as a book dealer. I was able to pick up some Swan Down items for bibliographical compilation, including an unknown Sinclair A item, which was a pamphlet housed in a full-sized plastic swan lore. That afternoon, I met with poet-publisher Nick Johnson at his flat in St. Leonard's. I had met Nick and his exuberant dog a couple of months previously in London. He was another early supporter of the bibliography idea. And the leisurely afternoon was spent with more coffee, biscuits, book talk, and Sinclairian anecdotage. Nick runs Etruscan Books, which published Ian's Saddling the Rabbit and The Firewall, which is Ian's collected poems. There were two more trips that year. One in April 2013, which was an amazing four-day collaboration with Ian, and a marathon 2 weeks in late October 2013. This last trip coincided with the publication of Ian's book, American Smoke. American Smoke is, of course, about Ian's love of the Beats and other American writers of the period. The Beats loom large in Ian's legend, beginning with the teacher who suggested that he read Kerouac's Maggie Cassidy, certainly an important touchpoint for Ian. The frequency with which Kerouac, Burroughs, Ginsberg, Snyder, and others are mentioned in Ian's work and his conversation is striking. They are perhaps the most obvious influence upon the direction taken by Ian's writing in the 1960s and thereafter. Not being a beat or poetry guy, this was all new to me, and I found that it was impossible to proceed with a bibliography without dipping into the Beats and Black Mountain poets. The thing that struck me about all of them was the immediacy, urgency, and conscious subjectivity of the writing, and I was able to discern quite clearly the influence upon Ian and the others in the British poetry revival. And that's how I began my education in modernist and postmodernist poetry. As I read and delved, I found myself drawn again and again to Charles Olson, a figure that I knew literally nothing about when I began this effort. The result is that Olson has become a major interest for me, and I'm devouring everything that I can get my hands on. His interest in themes, the mythologization of place, the importance and influence of mythology, the sea, America losing its way, its detrimental puritanical roots, etc. I mean, all of this is underpinned by Jungian archetype. All of these things embody everything that I've been interested in literature for my entire life. Olson's works are a path into Ian's work, and Olson's 6-foot-8-inch presence hovers over the entirety of American Smoke. Olson described the prose that he used in Call Me Ishmael as his ambush prose. Well, he ambushed me. His writing somehow goes right into me, to my heart, brain, and gut. Something about it connects on a level that I can't describe. What has struck me, as I work on the Sinclair bibliography and research Olson, are the similarities, the resonances between the two. I hope, once I complete the bibliography, to be able to write an essay on these resonances between Sinclair and Olson, and another of my favorite authors, John Cooper Powys. All use mythology and the processes of mythologization as the basis for their writings. All are extraordinarily influenced by place. All wrote eccentric and difficult books. All three lectured widely, expounding upon the connections between literature, life, and ideas. All were not appreciated until their later years, when they developed devoted followings, having spent most of their lives on the fringe. Sometimes, let's be honest, on the fringe of the fringe. All were able to connect seemingly disparate ideas and events, weaving them together to create incredibly dense word tapestries. I thanked Ian numerous times for introducing me to Olson, as it has, ironically, allowed me to connect with American writing again. I tell people that, upon picking up the Maximus poems and Call Me Ishmael, it did feel like I was coming home, reconnecting with American writing through Olson's exploration of his mythologized city upon a hill. This led to a family vacation in Gloucester, meeting Greg Gibson, and the invitation to follow in Sinclair's footsteps as writer-in-residence, which has allowed me unencumbered time for a bibliographical compilation. Thank you both so much. At the end of all of this, hopefully within a couple years, lies a thick book that may or may not get published. If it doesn't, I'll publish it myself, which would, I think, nicely be in keeping with how Ian began back in 1970. I already know the size and format and look that I want, and a mainstream publisher won't touch it. I'm asked, has method bibliography yielded anything in terms of making the bibliography different or better? I don't know. We'll see. I think it has, but maybe not in terms of an easily quantifiable something or other. You see, I began this project by imitating those that came before me, their formats, leaving out what they left out and including what they put in. And I hated the result. Hated, hated, hated it. At the end of year one, I looked at the hundreds of pages I had completed and realized that this was not the bibliography that I wanted to publish. But what could I do? I didn't have the courage to break away from the norm. I was untrained, didn't have any credentials, nothing. It was Charles Olson that set me free. Now, that may sound melodramatic, but it's absolutely true. In Olson's essay entitled Projective Verse, he states that, per Robert Creeley, form is never more than an extension of content. Now, he was arguing for open-field poetry, that is to say, poetry that didn't conform to established forms, sonnets, rhyming couplets, etc. He believed that if the poet got it right, then the poem would be of a oneness in whatever shape it ultimately took. It would be true to itself via itself. I liked this, and as his writing had ambushed me, I kind of figured there might be something in it. I looked at the standard bibliographical format used in the past few decades for the Machine Age books, and I wondered the following. 1. Why is so much left out? These exclusions many times result in ambiguity when comparing a book to its compilation. 2. Why are compilations done in chunks, scattered through the compilation? Why isn't there an order, a form for the compilation, which is dictated via the order and form of book production? 3. Why are a book's contents glossed over in the compilation? And if present, why is the tabular format of the table of contents reduced to a semicolon delimited run-on mass of text on the page that almost always doesn't give the page numbers? Working through a poetry compilation especially is awful. 4. Why in God's name is everything reduced to a mass of text on the page? 5. If care is taken to present the author's text well on the page of a book, why isn't the same care taken when presenting a bibliographical compilation? If indeed form is never more than an extension of content, then I couldn't do the same with bibliographical If form is never more than an extension of content, then couldn't I do the same with bibliographical compilation? That is to say, to allow the inherent form of book production and organization to be reflected through the form of the compilation. So I redid everything. I spent a few weeks coming up with a format that allowed the text to spread across the page, not allowing for the writer's breath to come through to the reader as per Olson, but to allow anyone referencing the compilation to work through it in an orderly manner, without losing their place, as I have reformatted with as much clarity as I can, and have attempted to use a variety of techniques to unconsciously transmit as much information as is possible to the reader. Now, all of this is due to the lateral application of one of Olson's tenets to a format that he never intended it for. Had I not traveled, met Ian, heard about Olson, I would have never reached the point where I was set free from convention to develop my own style and format. Regardless of whether it works or not, this was never just about the final book. It's as much about the journey. I fulfilled long-held dreams of legitimate research, dipped into poetry, which I knew nothing about, donated money to independent film projects, purchased my first art objects, been able to offer various types of support to writers, artists, filmmakers, shopkeepers, book dealers. I've developed my own bibliographical standards, taught myself a new skill set, met, interviewed, and gotten to know dreamers and makers. I've stepped outside my comfort zone in a very big way and have managed to meet or exceed all of the things in which I wish to take a part. Energies have been generated, friendships and acquaintances with artists, filmmakers, writers, book dealers, publishers. These connections led to my being asked here tonight. An Olson obsession has developed. A short story idea has developed as well. I've come home to connect with American writing again, and interest in this project resulted in an interview with me that was subsequently published as a chapbook by a small UK publisher, something I would have never thought of, let alone hoped for. But an ancillary publication is, once again, nicely reflective of Ian's work. So keep in mind, none of this was asked for. It all arose out of method bibliography. It all arose out of pursuing something new and allowing Ian's process to do whatever it does and the resulting energies to do whatever it is that they do. The title of the chapbook and tonight's talk, Site Scout for the Territory, is actually a double literary joke. One of Ian Sinclair's most successful books is entitled Lights Out for the Territory. It was Huckleberry Finn, of course, who was going to lay out for the territory, meaning leave the area. Now, Ian's book is comprised of 9 essays about 9 walks in London, that is to say, 9 lightings out. But the phrase lights out also slyly describes the darkness Ian perceived in post-Thatcherite Britain. So my title reflects Ian's, and his title reflects Twain's quotation. So once again, I'm being brought home to the U.S. via a route through the U.K. Thousands of miles traveled, thousands of dollars spent traversing the world, chasing paper. An odyssey indeed. Thank you for coming.
Okay.
Quite a journey.
Well, yes.
Very
well
good. Yeah. Very well done.
Do you think of a future of bibliography as a term bibliography in some way? As you say, books are changing, if not vanishing.
I don't know what's going to happen, but one of the other writers in residence here, her picture is up on the wall there. Some what they were doing is based upon the fact that they think books are an endangered species as well. As to bibliography, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it's already degenerated.
Well, you're what's happening. The form is
it degenerating, literally, as a genre?
No, I think it's sort of like ossified. In a way that may not answer all the things that are happening to books, which I think Jeff is you grasp that and are attempting to answer that problem. And you know, I'd just like to say, I realized while you were writing this, this is one of the sweetest, most wonderful, benign midlife crises I've ever encountered. And you know, you're just pulling it off, man. It's really sweet.
I originally had that in the talk.
Yeah.
That it's definitely a midlife.
You had
definitely
that,
a
midlife.
Yeah. It's definitely. But I pulled it out because. But it definitely was. Had to do something different.
Yeah, had to do.
Yeah. Good on you.
So. I just find it, if you will, sad. That books are just being discarded, and it does bother me. It bothers me quite a bit. In the pamphlet that was published, which I sent Greg a copy
of.
In the pamphlet that was published.
Did you bring copies for sale? I pictured say 50 people here and
no.
A brisk.
That's the pamphlet that was published. That's just an interview. It's kind of the talk that I just gave. But I mean that was just insane. That somebody wanted to do that. But I was approached for that.
No, Kevin Ring did it.
Yeah. You know Kevin?
Yeah.
Kevin's great.
We tried to get him over here, but he doesn't leave. He doesn't talk to people in person.
No. Okay. So. Anyway, yeah, you're very perceptive, Greg, about the midlife thing.
Well, I like the idea of it. I like the conceit, I guess. How close do you think you are to being finished?
I mean,
as we said at lunch, some of these guys spent their whole lives doing these things.
Well, it's kind of funny. What seems to, they seem to take between 6 and 8 years to do a really proper one, a really good one. And one of the reasons for that is you got to give stuff time to shake out. Stuff that's been buried, stuff that maybe copies aren't available on the market, or I honestly don't know. And because I'm only grabbing this at spare moments to do it. It's just a spare moment thing and a couple of weeks off every year to travel to London or to travel here to write, so.
Well,
Does the bibliographies include all the remarks about Sinclair, too, the essays on Sinclair?
Okay.
This gets into time.
Good ones do, and my intention certainly is to do that. With a section on books about Sinclair or his works being discussed, or there have been a handful of books specifically published just about his work.
Yeah.
But he seems to crop up in any book that talks about London. He crops up in those. So those, of course, won't get the major treatment that everything else gets, but a mention of some sort.
Well, in this sense, the bibliography is never completed. It has to go along with the internet. I mean, I'm aware of reading myself older books. Speaking of, this bibliography is fine in 1980, say, mm-hmm. but now so much else has gone on, and so it can never stop because of books about books.
Yeah, the A items
and
stop.
And discoveries, yeah.
But as you get up the alphabet, it just continually generated.
Yeah.
Right?
And that's one of the problems. Virtually every bibliography that I have states in the introduction, this book will be out of date as soon as it's published. And that's one of the problems with them.
Yeah.
But for, like Greg said, for the actual works by the author, at a certain point, those are all encapsulated within the bibliography, but the writings about will continue. Yeah. One of the interesting things about Ian's bibliography is going to be a section on contributions to art objects. Like I said, one of the most interesting, I was telling Greg at lunch, is they designed a watch. You can actually buy it. It's very nice. Where instead of having the numbers on it, it has six London writers' last names. And the six names are associated with the part of London in which they wrote. And that's the watch face.
Who were the writers?
I knew you'd ask me. And I
besides
forget.
Dickens. Through the ages? Shakespeare?
No. They were ones that Ian really sort of has a passion for.
Oh, okay.
So they were more recent writers. And I honestly, off the top of my head, can't remember, even though I own one. Sorry about
Lovecraft,
that.
By any chance?
No.
Because he has a passion for Lovecraft.
Yeah. Like Lovecraft. No, what was it? Lovecraft. Kirsch. Gerald Kirsch was one of them.
Ballard.
Ballard.
Yeah.
Ballard was one of them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I can't remember the other four, but yeah, it's. And of course, Ian has a new film coming out that he just did with Andrew Cotting. It's sort of a filmic response to John Clare's Journey Out of Essex.
Wow.
Yeah, well, he's fascinated by sort of writers of the supernatural, like Hodgson, for example, mm-hmm. The House in the Borderland.
Hodgson,
and,
yep.
Somebody who's not known so well.
I find it very interesting. Maybe you found this too, Greg. That some of these, very literary, very major authors really enjoy pulp. They really enjoy pulp.
You know, it's like the rich family likes to get a peasant girl in there every once in a while to improve the stock. I think there's something really vigorous about that kind of stuff. But
vigorous is a good word. What I think it may be is because pulp is just pure storytelling. You know, there's
sometimes of the worst.
Well, sometimes bad, but or you look at an author like Moorcock. He's written everything. He's written absolutely everything.
You know, the part I forgot to say in my introduction about bibliographies is that if you're an author and you don't have a bibliography, and then you do have a bibliography of your works, your collectability just skyrockets. And we talked a little bit about this at lunch, mm-hmm. but I think it's certainly in... You present yourself as a credible person who's doing this thing, whether it's traditional or not, and it must be certainly in Ian's interest to encourage you as much as he possibly can, because a bibliography about Sinclair will be the beginning of the Sinclair collecting industry in the best of all possible worlds. And he's certainly aware of that.
He's aware of that, and he is very encouraging. I don't know if it came out during the talk, but I mean, he is... The level of support that he gives to this idiot flying over from America is just stunning. The time that he takes, and he still sends me updates. So it's been a blast.
Well, I mean, you're credible to him in that you're just nutty enough to you're in his zone somehow, and I don't know what that correspondence is, but I can sense that.
Well, then maybe I can end with this little anecdote. It's funny that you said that. We were sitting at the kitchen table, myself, Ian, and his wife, Anna, and just talking. And I actually took this out of the talk. We were talking, and he was talking about how he kind of attracts nutters. He attracts very eccentric, very different people. And he says, the worst ones are the ones that call at 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning. He said, but most wait until, you're up and around before they call you with some crazy scheme. So we're talking about this. And I'm saying, yeah, well, that must be difficult. And I don't know how you deal with it and how you handle it. And I said, so my letter must have come as sort of a relief from all that. And Ian and Anna went completely silent and just stared at me. And I realized I was one of them.